I'm Matt, one of the church staff, and I know it's Mother's Day, but I wonder if anybody here had an embarrassing dad growing up? Yes, Isaac Hickford, you did. Anybody else have an embarrassing dad? Yeah. Well, when I was growing up, my dad was a vicar, and he used to come into my school and do school assemblies, which I never looked forward to at the best of times, because it was my dad's. And one day he came to me, and I was probably about 13 or 14, and he said, "Right, son, next week I'm coming into school, and I'm going to do the sex talk." And all my friends were going to be there. And I said, "Well, you know what, there's no need, because we all know what happens. So you don't need to do that. Why don't you do the God Loves Everyone talk? That one's brilliant. Do that one again. Let's do that." And he said, "Oh, no, don't worry. It'll be fine. Don't worry about it." And I should have bunked off. We get to the day. As it happens, I'm sat bang in the middle of the front row, surrounded by my mates, obviously, because it was always going to pan out that way. And the teacher introduced him, and my dad came up, and I'm not joking, this happened. My dad's opening line, there's hundreds of people there, I'm 13, all my mates around, I'm sat in the front in the middle. My dad's opening line was this: "Sex is absolutely amazing, I've done it well over 1,000 times." One of the most horrific moments of my teenage years. It's the fact that he'd done some arithmetic around it. That's just sad. I nearly rang Childline. It was terrible. I think for about 3 weeks I got, "Wormsley's dad's a sex machine." Anyway, so today we're going to talk about sex. I won't be as bad as my dad. And you might already be thinking, "I've come the wrong week. This isn't for me." You might be thinking, "Well, I'm not having sex right now, or I'm not going to, or I'm having plenty of sex and I don't want to talk about it, thank you very much." You might be sat here this morning and you might not be a Christian, a follower of Jesus, and you're thinking, "Well, I've got some interest in this Christianity stuff, fine, but do we have to talk about sex? Can't people just do what they want to do in the privacy of their own home, and, you know, it's nobody else's business? Why do we have to talk about it?" But the fact is, it affects everybody. The reason it affects everybody is sex is so much a part of human relationships that how society views it, how we view it, is extremely important. So before we look at the Bible, I want to back up a little bit and just look at where our culture is at with sex. You see, right now, there is no fixed view that our society has on what is healthy sexual expression. There's no view that is held by basically everybody. Is it only for marriage? Is it for a man and a woman? Is it for any number of people? Is it okay on your own? Should it be in a committed relationship? Is it okay to pay for it? Can a relationship be meaningful without it? There is no agreement on these questions. There's no agreement. But there are some big ideas that shape how society approaches this issue. Firstly, we're into individualism. It's not controversial to say our society is quite individualistic. We have to be careful because some of the best bits about individualism are grounded in Christian thought. Everybody has value. Each person has innate freedom. But separated out of community and mutuality, individualism has become something like this: I rule over all things. My morality, my identity, who I am, is all defined by me alone. And if it's all about me and my preferences and my determination of myself, I'm under no obligation in our culture to commit to my sexual partner beyond what is convenient for me. I can pursue sex for the sake of the experience, not the person. I might have an affection for them, I might be committed to them, I may even marry them, but the point is, I don't have to in our culture. I don't have to. I can get out whenever I choose. And we have the freedom in our culture to have sex with whoever, whenever, as much as we want, and that's what you can do. Also, at the same time, we are into romance. All people at all times have been interested in sex, but our culture has a particular thing where we idolize, we worship sex, perhaps more than anybody ever has. We look to a romantic relationship to fulfill every need. We look for the perfect partner to complete us and give us meaning. And it's not just out there. People in church do this too. We struggle to imagine a meaningful life without a partner, even as Christians. And many people don't just question, but cannot comprehend why you would not choose to go about life having as much sex as you possibly can. Are you mad? Go out and get some. Why wouldn't you? The worship of sex is so powerful, it's used to sell everything else. It's like, buy this new car and you'll definitely have more sex. We know the sex is what you really want, but our Toyota Prius will help you get there. Maybe not Prius. Of course, the reason this works is we all want something that is beyond ourselves, something bigger and better, something that takes us above ourselves. And we know that sex promises to get us there. So we turn it into an absolute life goal. It becomes all-consuming. It's everywhere. At the same time, we're into materialism. And when we say materialism, we might think of somebody who just likes to do lots of shopping. But more than that, materialism is when we believe that everything just has a natural cause. There's no God, no afterlife, no greater reality beyond what you can see and hear. And this assumption right now is pretty powerful. And there are signs that it's changing, but it's quite a big deal. And so this is paradoxical. On the one hand, we want sex because it takes us beyond ourselves. It's closeness and it's fun. And on the other hand, our materialism tells us that we're just animals. We happen to have bigger brains. Sex is meaningless. It's just about reproducing. So you might as well have as much fun as you possibly would like, because at the end of the day, sex has the same profound spiritual value as eating a Twix. That's where it leads. It's about sating an appetite. If you have a good time on the way there, cool. And if that's true, that means that pornography, multiple partners, sex outside any commitment, it's all fine. Do what you like, because it's meaningless. It's just an appetite. It's not sacred. And that means there's no guilt. There's no strings attached. And yet, somehow, people regularly get hurt. People still get hurt. The real thing that's going on, sorry, I seem to have missed a slide here. Oh, well. The real thing, I believe, is it's all a search for intimacy and transcendence. It's a search for intimacy and transcendence. That's what everybody really wants. Intimacy and transcendence. But that's not what we look for. That's not the sort of terminology that we use every day. Unless you're reading up on sociology and philosophy, that's not what you bump into. It's just assumed. What we come across every day is story. It's a Hollywood movie where the main characters overcome every obstacle because they love each other. It's the magazine story about the woman who left her partner, lost 10 pounds, and now has amazing sex 3 times a day, apparently. And with all this going on, all the apparent joy, all the freedom to do what you like with no consequences, the classic Christian view on sex and relationships seems on the surface to be a bit conservative, and it seems a bit old-fashioned, and it seems a bit dull. Married man and woman, committed to each other, year after year after year after year. Either way, whatever we believe about our lives is one thing, but we should ask ourselves, what's actually happening? What actually happens in real life? The ideas our culture tells us about sex are very powerful, but we should ask, is it working? All this permission and encouragement to have sex with whoever, whenever, forever, it sounds great, doesn't it? It sounds like freedom. But what's the outcome? What actually happens? People say that the sexual revolution began in the 60s, so we're 50 years in. And I think we can ask how it's going. Strip away the magazines and the films. Let's just look at the naked statistics. And these are all based on this country. Let me be clear about that. Here are some stats for you. I did some homework. According to an Ipsos poll in 2018, the men surveyed, there was loads of them, guessed that men aged 18 to 29 have sex, on average, 180 times a year. The reality, the research says, is that the average is 50. It's quite a big difference. Men also guessed that women aged 18 to 29 have sex 22 times a month. The reality is 5. According to the British National Survey of Sexual Attitudes and Lifestyles in 2014, people are having sex on average 2 to 3 times a week, when in previous decades it was 5. That's a huge drop. It's virtually halved. According to Public Health England in 2018, half of women aged 25 to 34 don't enjoy sex at all. Half. of women in the prime of their lives don't enjoy sex at all. According to the Observer Sex Survey from 2008 to 2014, the number of people who saw themselves as good at sex, whatever that means, dropped from 55% to 33%. The national libido is in decline. Sexual satisfaction is in decline. That's an enormous drop in just 6 years of how people perceive themselves sexually. We go on. The average number of sexual partners a person has in a lifetime has gone up. The average is now 6 to 10, with the mean being 9.5. I don't know how you have sex with half a person, but people are into weird stuff. But according to Nicholas Wolfinger, a sociologist from the Institute of Family Studies, he says this: the evidence suggests the more sexual partners you've had, the less satisfying you find sex to be. The more sexual partners you've had, the less satisfying you find sex to be. Isn't that fascinating? Continue. Porn usage. 13% of the entire internet is porn. 13%. Think of all the things that humans discuss, do, talk about. Outer space, crochet, ice hockey, spreadsheets, reggae, donuts, architecture, the news. There's so many things that we could talk about and do and think about. All the stuff that there is, an eighth of the total sum of what's on the internet is porn, and a third of what's downloaded is pornography. The most popular day of the week for watching porn is a Sunday. If only there's something else you could do to have your relational needs met on a Sunday. Sunday is also statistically the loneliest day of the week. Goes hand in hand. Porn brings in more money than Google, Apple, Amazon, eBay, Yahoo, and Netflix combined. Combined. And this is really interesting. More than 50% of those seeking sexual interaction online claim to have diminished desire for real-life sex, and interestingly, a third of the partners of those people claimed the same. In other words, if your partner regularly watches pornography, your desire for sex diminishes, regardless of whether or not you know that they do. That's really interesting. So what does all this tell us? What all this tells us is that 50 years into the great freedoms of the sexual revolution, we're having less sex, we're having worse sex, we think that everybody else is having better and more sex than they actually are, and we're paying an absolute fortune to watch other people do it. It's going really well, isn't it? Let me put it to you that the approach to sex our culture has doesn't work. It doesn't work. If we're serious about sex, we're doing it wrong. This is the huge irony. Our culture needs a new position, pun intended. The story doesn't add up. The magazines and the films and social media are lying. They tell us everybody's out there having amazing sex with everybody else every 10 minutes, and it's all possible because of all this great freedom, and we've released ourselves from the shackles, or kept them on if that's your thing. But you have choice, and it's wonderful, apparently. It's all amazing. Except it's not true. The reality is close to the opposite. For all the bits and pieces that are great about the last 50 years in our culture, we've lost our way on this. Surely there has to be a better way to understand sex. Surely we can do better. As I said, I think, really, it's a search for intimacy and transcendence. That's what everybody wants. Intimacy and transcendence. To be really close to somebody and yet have your mind blown in wonder. To be completely known, good and bad, and yet completely accepted and embraced. Christians might say that perhaps unknowingly, everybody is seeking the joy found only in the true God. Seeking the joy found only in the true God. So, does the old book that we look at every week have anything helpful to say about sex? We've been looking at the New Testament letter called 1 Corinthians. It was written to a church with a lot going on. And one thing that we've noted is that the city of Corinth was so famous for sex that if you slept around in the ancient world, it was called Corinthianizing. That was their reputation. And people in the church were doing the same. So it's not that the people who received this letter were prudish, naive simpletons. They knew about sex. The people in Corinth had lots of sex with lots of people. They know about it. And this is what Paul writes to them. I have the right to do anything, you say, but not everything is beneficial. I have the right to do anything, but I will not be mastered by anything. You say food for the stomach and the stomach for food, and God will destroy them both. The body, however, is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord also for the body. By his power, God raised the Lord from the dead, and he will raise us also. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ himself? Shall I then take the members of Christ and unite them with a prostitute? Never. Do you not know that he who unites himself with a prostitute is one with her in body? For it is said, the two will become one flesh. But whoever is united with the Lord is one with him in spirit. Flee from sexual immorality. All other sins a person commits are outside the body, but whoever sins sexually sins against their own body. Do you not know that your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have received from God? You are not your own. You were bought at a price. Therefore, honour God with your bodies. This passage is absolutely amazing. If our world took hold of this passage and owned it as true, it would revolutionise human relationships. It really would. And it starts with Paul saying the sort of things that the Corinthians would say. These were the kind of sayings that would go around. And remember, it is Christians he's writing to. And they said things like, I have the right to do anything. It's so different from our culture, isn't it? So different. I can do what I like. I don't need somebody coming in and telling me different, tell me what to do. Paul's reply is amazing. But not everything is beneficial. I will not be mastered by anything. They're saying, well, we can do whatever we like. We've got the freedom. We can do what we want. And Paul says, fine, okay. But why not think about whether it's any good? Why not think about whether it's beneficial, whether it works? What's the outcome? Does it work? That's like the question that we've just asked when we looked at the statistics around our culture. The data says no. People in Corinth also said things like, food for the stomach and the stomach for food, and God will destroy them both. And that was an old saying that basically meant, you may as well do what you like, because at the end of the day, what happens in this life doesn't matter. That's what that saying meant, and it was popular. And it's a bit like the materialism of our culture, but for different reasons. It's saying, what happens in this physical life, in the physical world, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all. There's nothing transcendent or sacred or special. And Paul pushes back on this, and he gives a higher, more meaningful view of the body and of sex. And he says some astonishing things in response. So we're going to divide this up into three things, because Paul says this phrase, do you not know, three times. Do you not know? He's desperate for them to know. So let's look at the three do you not knows. Do you not know your bodies are members of Christ himself? Shall I then take the members of Christ and unite them with a prostitute? Never. Now, the original Greek word used for unite here is the verb kolan. And that's a word that was normally used to talk about being united as if you were married. And the word implies that being sexually united with somebody, even a one-off union between somebody and a prostitute, is the same as the union of marriage on one level. It's quite an interesting way of putting it. And this is huge because if this is true, it means that sex is more than just a physical thing. It's more than just a physical thing. It's more than a leisure activity. It's a beautiful and wonderful idea. Lots of people thought then, as they do now, that the body was just a container, a box for your soul or your mind. It's low, it's base, it doesn't matter. But so Paul says, no, because of the way that God made you, your body is important, and what you do with it matters. It's important. And this means, by the way, there is no such thing as casual sex. There can't be. Every sexual act is an expression of commitment. You know, some people think the Christian approach to sex is really naive. A number of years ago, I had a mate who, he was an RE teacher, and he asked me to come into his class and talk about what Christians believe. Not about sex, but just generally. And of course, I was trying very hard not to be like my dad. But when it opened for questions, the first question was this teenage girl, and she said, do you think sex outside marriage is okay? And I said, well, of course you could do what you like, but no, I don't think it's a good thing. And then, of course, they all laughed. And I said, so why are you laughing? And they said, well, that's just really naive. And I said, okay, I bet you can easily find me somebody who had sex outside marriage that regrets it. And they said, yeah. And I said, but I bet you'll struggle to find somebody who waited until they were married that regrets it. And they agreed, again, It's naive to think you can be sexually united with somebody and there be no consequences. That is naive. Sex is loaded with significance. It's an act of commitment. Obviously, waiting for marriage doesn't mean that sex will be brilliant every single time. But people who wait for that commitment, in general, tend to be happy that they've done so, because the highs and lows that come through your experience of sex are best done as part of a loving and committed relationship. There's this great truth here that Christians are personally united to God himself, and it's not just a weird, vague spiritual thing. The body is part of that too. That means your body has great value. It has great value. Some of us might look in the mirror and struggle to believe that, but it's true. Phil Corum, your body has great value before God. Sentence I never thought I'd say. You are so much more valuable than you realize. So much that goes wrong sexually in our world is because people don't see themselves as valuable. It goes wrong, people don't see themselves as valuable. So people look to find value by having sex with somebody that they shouldn't. And it never works. You will never feel valuable doing that. Or people don't see somebody else as valuable, so they use them for sex like they'd borrow a library book. What if that was different? The message of this text is your body is staggeringly valuable. And if you're a member of Christ, if you're a Christian, you are part of God's community on earth. This is why at this point in the text, Paul doesn't say anything about how going to a prostitute is abusive. That was happening in Corinth. He doesn't tell them, oh, that's abusive. He doesn't say using another person as a commodity is wrong. And those things are true. At this point, he says, don't sleep with a prostitute because as a Christian, it violates your union with God. There is something about sex in this way, something that's outside God's ways, that is deeply harmful and wrong. It cuts us off from God himself. And the point continues and goes further. Do you not know that he who unites himself with a prostitute is one with her in body? For it is said the two will become one flesh. But whoever is united with the Lord is one with him in spirit. Flee from sexual immorality. All of the sins a person commits are outside the body, but whoever sins sexually sins against their own body. As we've seen, when somebody unites with a prostitute, they are united in a way that's like marriage. And Paul even quotes a verse from the beginning of the Bible in Genesis. The two will become one flesh. You'd never think, would you, that the Bible would connect this wonderful holistic expression of marriage with sleeping with a prostitute. That he puts the two together. The reason he does it is to underline sex is a type of promise, a commitment. It's supposed to be coupled with an absolute commitment to the other person, the kind of commitment expressed in marriage. And every time you are sexually active without that commitment, you rewire your own brain. You rewire your brain. That's why very often, not always, but very, very often, those with a sex addiction or a porn addiction struggle with real life commitment. Their brains have been rewired, they've been coached so that sex and commitment don't go together. When you give your body but not yourself in sex, you are damaging your own ability to commit and therefore your own ability to experience real intimacy. So the more you search for it by having sex or thinking about sex in the wrong way or whatever it may be, you actually limit your own ability to experience intimacy with another person. That's why there are warnings. The term one flesh doesn't just mean your literal body tissue. It means your embodied personhood, your you-ness. If two people become one flesh and you're one of those people, your very self is changed. Sex changes you. So the message here is never have physical oneness, never have sex without whole life oneness. Don't be physically vulnerable without becoming all vulnerable, emotionally, financially, life commitment. And if you do it right, it will transform your life. By the way, as an aside, if you're married and you want to have better sex, that woke some people up, didn't it? If you want to have better sex, be more open and vulnerable with your spouse. It is related. That means being direct and communicating, even when it's awkward or uncomfortable. But more than that, when you're open and vulnerable in your marriage, the more that feeds into your sex life. Be financially vulnerable with your partner. Share your bank accounts. Be emotionally vulnerable. Share how you feel. Be committed regardless of what you're getting back. These are the things that are supposed to go along with sex. And the more you separate them, the worse your sex life will be and the worse your relationship will be. The more you join them, the better it will be. Honestly, it's not just buying the odd present or, you know, cleaning yourself up a bit and hoping to get lucky. It's building your relationship. And that's why Paul writes, not just avoid this stuff, but flee from sexual immorality. Run away as far as possible. The word that he uses here, which we translate as sexual immorality, is porneion, which is where we get the word pornography from. But it comes from the word porneo, which means selling off. Selling off. That's not an accidental word. Paul's saying, when you're sexually immoral, when you use sex in a way that's not God's, you're selling yourself off. You're selling yourself off, and you're getting the other person to do the same. That's not being negative. That's saying don't ruin something that's positive and wonderful. It's only because your body and how you use it for intimacy matters that this selling off is a problem. You're valuable, remember? Why would you want to sell yourself off? This is the highest view of sex there could possibly be. But what I love about the Christian take on sex, and even though it's higher than all the other views, it's not ultimate. It's not ultimate. In the center of these verses, there's this one amazing line, and it gets missed because it's between all the sexual morality and prostitute stuff, which looks more interesting. And it says, whoever is united with the Lord is one with him in spirit. Whoever is united with the Lord is one with him in spirit. The main reason to run away from all this stuff is because of something greater. You don't want to miss out on it. In our world, we tend to make sex and romantic relationships the be-all and end-all. We look for somebody to complete us, to give us identity and purpose. The modern Western world is the only civilization in history to lack any belief in any ultimate future beyond this life. If that's true, time is short. We're desperate to find the one true love to make us happy, supposedly. But the Bible says, no. Make God your one true love. Make God your one true love. Sex is amazing. It's a brilliant invention. But you don't need it to live. Don't make it your life. As great as it is, it's just a dim reflection of what will be. Just as two lovers are united in sex, and it's more than just two sets of flesh, in the same way, the whole of sex is a huge signpost to exactly the sort of union that God wants with his people. It's a signpost to something even better. And because of that, we get the third thing. Do you not know? Do you not know that your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have received from God? You are not your own. You were bought at a price. Therefore, honor God with your bodies. You are not your own. You're not your own. Those words sound very possessive, don't they? You're not your own. But wait, the reason you're not your own is incredible. And this is the most important thing we're going to talk about here. This is incredible. You were bought. The reason you're not your own is you were bought. Jesus purchased you on the cross personally. You're valuable, remember? The whole perspective of this, the whole posture of the Bible on sex, is based on the fact that Jesus literally gave his own self, his own body, to purchase us. And so he has claim to us. It's one of those things, there's loads of things like this in the Bible, that's both reassuring and uncomfortable. It's reassuring and it's uncomfortable. And it's why Paul can say, flee from sexual immorality, you were bought at a price. When we pursue sex outside God's intention, we're selling ourselves off, remember? So it's no accident that here Paul uses the language of Jesus purchasing us. We sell ourselves off sexually, but he's the one who purchases people. What does that mean? The Bible, in a number of places, uses the language of God purchasing us or paying a ransom for us. It never actually specifically says who's being paid. It's a strange idea. It does say that our wrongdoing, our rejection of God, including our sexual wrongs, needs paying for. We were made for a relationship. We were made for an intimate relationship with a transcendent God. But we blew it. We use God's goodness for our own selfishness. We use sex for our own gratification. We use it to try and find ourselves. But God still wanted us. God still wanted us. He wanted us to experience the intimacy and transcendence that sex points to. The kind of self-giving that we struggle with and get wrong, he's already done. Sex done the right way is about being vulnerable. But we mess it up. But Jesus makes himself vulnerable on the cross. Sex done the right way is about losing your independence. But we mess it up. But Jesus loses his independence on the cross. Sex done the right way is about self-giving. But we mess it up. But Jesus gives himself most fully on the cross. Our bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit. In other words, we are places where the living God takes up residence. He purchases us and he moves in our inner being. This sounds to me a lot like the sort of intimacy and transcendence we're looking for. The powerful, amazing God who's up there and can do everything and is over everything, and yet he's in here. He moves in here. He's intimate and he's transcendent. He's both. So the bottom line is this. What we seek and enjoy through sexual experience points to the intimacy and transcendence for which Jesus has already purchased us. What we seek and enjoy through sexual experience points to the intimacy and transcendence for which Jesus has already purchased us. What's all this got to do with us today? To be honest, the number of implications of talking about sex are so wide, we could be here for a lot longer. But briefly, I think that virtually everybody is affected by sexual sin. In other words, your own selfishness or somebody else's selfishness when it comes to sex, or both. It might not be happening right now, but I bet it has or will. And it could be that you're single and you're affected by what our culture says, that apparently you need to have a relationship to have a meaningful life, and it makes you sad. It could be that you're married and your partner doesn't want sex right now for some reason, and that makes you feel rejected. It could be that your partner does want sex, but they haven't treated you in a way that makes you want to have sex right now, and you feel conflicted. It could be that you've experienced sexual abuse, and you feel angry, or you feel dirty. It could be that you're a sexual abuser, whether in real life or through what you expose yourself to on TV or the internet, and you feel guilty, or you feel ashamed. It could be that you've had sexual encounters that you wish had never happened, and you feel like you can't look God in the eye, so to speak. It could be that you're exploring Christianity, and you're very sensitive about your sexual experiences and desires, and you don't want to be judged by others, and you're afraid that God will reject you if he's for real. And I want to be really, really, really clear about this. What you do sexually matters. It does. That's because you're valuable. But whatever you've done, or thought, or regret in terms of sex, whatever has been done to you, God does not reject you. God does not reject you. He's died to purchase you. He wants you to be free. Jesus' own blood was spilt for you. You are not beyond God's reach. Whatever it is, you are not beyond God's reach. But it might be helpful to speak to him today. So the prayer team are going to be available a bit later in the service, I believe, and after the service, to pray with anybody who wants to do that. I'm very aware this is a thing where you might not feel comfortable coming up to the front and praying with somebody, because it will look like you've got some deep, dark sexual thing going on. Last week, Becca spoke about incest, and nobody came forward for prayer after that. Can we just give each other permission to come forward for prayer and not assume that it's related to some terrible thing? People come for prayer for all sorts of things anyway. But as I said, the team will also be available after the service. Or if you're just not comfortable going there this morning, do get in touch with me or do get in touch through the office this week if you'd like to chat with somebody about this. Or find somebody who's here, find a friend that you can talk about this through, because this is big stuff. What has happened to you sexually, what you've experienced from somebody else, what you've done, matters. Because you're valuable. But Jesus purchased you.